Man, I love that jazz. I love the blues, the jazz. It's really good stuff. And that piece of lead-in music, that's actually a kind of a homegrown original piece here. So, but I love that. I just love that sound, you know. Tonight is a free-for-all night here at the Meat House. So we're going to be missing one here tonight. Aaron Martin, he's got a business commitment that he needed to attend to. He may or may not join us a little bit later. Ryan Richardson's in the house with us tonight. So is Jeff Schaus, Mississippi Chris along for the ride. And again, this is the Meat House. I want to keep on listening to that tune playing in the background. tonight is free for all night, and you know, whatever's on our minds, tonight. So we're just going to talk about anything and everything concerning the meads, the braggots, the beers. Whatever it is that we come up with there tonight. But usually when we start out the show, I kind of cruise through all the Facebook pages and looking for something interesting. And tonight, another busy day, but I did manage to get out to the Fruit, Wine, and Mead Making Facebook group. This is a post, and I'm probably going to butcher this name, J. Renee, I guess is the name. And I don't know if that's a female or a male. I'm going to assume it's a female, the J-A-Y-E. She put up a photograph of some different things. She's got a chocolate salted caramel port. She's got a freezer clean out wine. So I'm going to guess that's probably just a lot of mixed fruit. Thrown in the hopper with some sugar added and some yeast. She's got a pear and cardamom mead going. She's got an herbal mead, a peach lavender mead, a plum shiso jujube mead, a maple syrup and hickory syrup, and I guess it's called Yaupon, Y-A-U-P-O-N. Holly Mead. So, some terrific ideas there for different flavor profiles. J. Renee from Fruit, Wine, and Mead Making Facebook group. And if you get over there and take a look at that picture, she's got them all lined up. Looks like 1 gallon carboys there. Kind of pretty, actually, all the different colors of her projects working. So be eager to find out how they turn out. So, Jay, if you're listening, give us a shout-out. Let us know how they turned out. And, heck, come on the show and tell us in person. What are we drinking? I'm gonna take a wild stab at Mississippi. I'm going to guess probably... Because I know he may have to cut out and actually go to work tonight. So I got to figure that he's probably got some dark roast in a tall cup.
Regular size cup.
Regular size
almost
cup.
Got it. Yep. Actually, I've got two. I've got a cup of coffee, and I've got a glass of unsweet tea. I couldn't decide which one I wanted, so I got both. And I'm sitting on both.
Unsweet tea?
Yeah. I'm off the sugar, remember, for a while?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was going to say that. And that's probably hard to stomach, isn't it? You from the South drinking. I mean, it's like. That's like hamburger without the cheese or peanut butter without the jelly, or you know.
Yeah, it's wrong, but you know, you get used to it.
Ryan Richardson in the house here tonight. Ryan, what are you drinking, bud?
Well, I'm inspired by the braggots we're working on, And because the beer style that I'm making is going to be a sweet stout, I am drinking one of my favorite sweet stouts, just a beer, not a braggot, from a local brewery here in Minneapolis. It's called Maggie's Leap from Northgate Brewing, and it is canned on nitro. So oh, wow. I am drinking a tall can of that, well, I should say in a glass, and just projecting on what the finished braggots is going to taste like.
Wow, that sounds good. You know, Guinness has this little gizmo. Did that come in your beer as well? It's got this little gizmo that does something. I have no idea.
It's called a widget. And I was really surprised. I thought that was needed to can something on nitro. This one was not. You know, it's just an empty can here after I've looked, you know, poured it out. But it does have that nice creamy cascading head when I poured it into a glass.
What the hell does that widget do anyway? I mean, what's that thing supposed to do?
I don't know if nitrogen needs to be agitated, and that's what that widget's doing for you.
I don't know.
I took one science class to fulfill my college requirement, and we didn't cover that.
You missed the part on witches.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Back when I went to school, they didn't even have science classes. So we learned how to bale hay and feed horses. So
you had to walk uphill both ways, didn't you?
Yeah. What was that, Jeff?
I was about to say my physics and chemistry curriculum were, you know, woefully absent of the topic of beer too. So, you know.
Well, what's in your cup here tonight, Jeff?
You know, I also was thinking back to last week's episode and about the nitro, and I actually picked up something a little bit different tonight. It's Nitro White Ale by Sam Adams. It's a wit beer, so it's a light kind of lager with a little bit of like the coriander and orange peel flavoring to it. But it's on nitro, so it's got this very like smooth, creamy head. It's just really light, delightful.
Yeah. Wow. Sounds good. Well, boys, I'm drinking a beer tonight, and I've been on this bourbon thing, and I believe I've made my selection for both my bourbon barrel beer and the braggot. But I've been on this bourbon barrel beer thing, aged stouts and whatnot. I found another one that I kind of like. Although it's a little bit on the sweet side for me. But it's got some good aged bourbon flavor. It's called Dragon's Milk. This is put out by New Holland Brewing. And I wished I could tell you where they're located, but even the glasses, my reading glasses, I can't even see the writing on the back of the label. So that's how small it is. But New Holland Brewing, if anybody wants to Google that, Dragon's Milk Bourbon Barrel Aged Stout. And this is really good. What I'm doing, I'm kind of looking for something to give me an idea of what direction I want to go with my bourbon barrel beer when I get it going. Now, I said, a couple of shows ago or even the last show that I was going to do this side-by-side thing with the bourbon barrel thing, but I decided different. My wife has to come first, so with the two empty fermenters, I got my braggot started in one, and I got a nice coffee stout started in the other one for her. So the bourbon barrel beer porter is just going to have to wait until I get an empty fermenter. So, but it, you know, it kind of, it gives me some time because, you know, we've been going. I've been on a mission of sorts. I'm still on a hunt for bourbon, and I've got a list that I thought I would share tonight, and of some bourbons that, you know, I'm trying to get my hands on, but I'm finding it rather difficult. One is Pappy Van Winkle, and if you do your homework on bourbons, Pappy Van Winkle is one of the best out there. Very highly rated and very difficult to find. Another one is Blanton's. Now you got to get there are like Jack Daniels. I mean, there are Jack Daniels out there, but then there's Jack Daniels out there, and some of them are just, you know, a little bit pricey, a little bit difficult to find. The same thing with Pappy Van Winkle, with Blanton's. I'm looking for the good stuff. Stag, George T. Stag is another one. That there, one called Stag, and then one called Stag Junior. Stag, the, I believe it's a 12, they may be older than 12 year, and I think the younger one is something like in the neighborhood of less than 10. But another one I picked up over the weekend was Four Roses Single Barrel. I really like that one. It's going to fall into third place, though, amongst my Eagle Rare and my Evan Williams Single Barrel. Jack Daniels puts out a nice bourbon, or actually it's a whiskey, Tennessee whiskey, but you got to get the single barrel. The old number seven, you know, and if you're going to mix a, you know, a whiskey sour or whatever, that's okay, but if you want a nice sipper, start with the single barrel stuff all the way up to the single barrel proof, which is kind of high on the alcohol side. But anyway, so that's kind of been my mission here. And so this is why the beer that I'm drinking tonight, this, you know, I've been going around, and they're hard to find. There's not a lot of them out there. These bourbon barrel aged, of course, that might be something new in the craft brewing. What do you think?
That the New Holland, that's in Michigan. I've had that one before. It's very good. As far as it being a new thing, I'm not quite sure if it's a new thing. I think there's always things that are trendy, you know, I still have not seen a proliferation of bourbon barrel beers quite in the same way that I have with fruit beers. I'd say over the last few years, there's just, you know, I think it started with kind of grapefruit, but I've seen just about every kind of fruit beer you can imagine lately all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen
like
this.
Sour beers have been popular too lately too.
Sour beer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like lemon sour? Sour or
sometimes they'll use odd bacterium like lactobacillus or I forget the other one, but it's
Brett.
The Brett and Brettanomyces. It's a different strain of yeast than the Saccharomyces. They will also use, and I've had some really good I forget how to pronounce it, but Gose or something like that, that was actually Goza. Made with the same kind of yeast. Goza, thank you. They made it with the same kind of bacterium that you use to make sauerkraut.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you get okay. You get like that tartness. Kind of
yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit like maybe a little bit of vinegar, but in a good way, if that makes sense.
You
do it right, and it gives you like that little acidic punch.
Yeah, it's kind of like fermenting foods, kimchi, sauerkrauts. I get you.
Yeah, there's two basic ways to sour a beer. The traditional way is aging. You know, it ages for 1 to 3 years, and you introduce this bacteria that really sours the beer. And when we say sour, it doesn't necessarily give it a puckery sour. You know, this is kind of the farmhouse. What am I? Netherlands is big into this, and some other areas that do it. And they can develop some really complex flavors, and they're very good, and they're very expensive, typically because they take so long to make, and when they do it in the traditional style, they're blended. It's a blend of 1, 2, and 3 year old beers until they get it just right, the way that a wine, you know, maker would kind of blend his wines. And the second way, which is more trendy because it can be done faster and it can it doesn't introduce bacteria into your brewery, is called kettle souring, which is the wort is first soured, and then after the wort is soured, then the boil takes place, which kills off all of the bacteria, leaving just the tartness behind. So that is kind of the tartness that you'll get. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's a little bit one-dimensional as opposed to those ones that have aged and really developed a lot of character in the flavors. But before I forget, on the bourbon JD, have you had the Willet?
No, you know, and I saw that at Total Wine, and I picked the bottle up, and it looked interesting. It's, you know, they get a little tag on the shelf that kind of explains some of the bourbons there, and I had second thoughts, and I put it down. Something you enjoy?
I enjoy it. I had a good friend who is very into bourbons and did a bourbon tasting. He had, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 bourbons, and we all did a sip of them. And the Willet's very good. So I recommend you give that a try sometime.
Yeah, I'll make it a point this week to go back over and pick up a bottle of it. Like I said, I picked it up. I looked at it. Looked interesting. Sounded interesting. But my mind was still on the three that I had gone in search of: the Blanton's, the Stag, and the Pappy Van Winkle. Which, you know, three strikes, you're out. So, but getting back to the sour thing. You know, I'm seeing more, Jeff, more in the sour mead thing coming out, too. I see more talk, more discussion about that. Has that shown up in any of the competitions, or is there a particular category for sour meads, or is it still too new to the mead making?
I think it is a little too new and a little too fringy. I've not seen any particular categories for it. I think that's still very much the open or experimental category. I know, is it Frank Golbeck at Gold Coast Meads has been playing around with those a lot, and he's had a lot of like really popular releases from those. But other than that, I don't know of too many like commercial meaderies that are putting stuff out for people to like be able to get that.
I think JD actually had one of Frank's sour
meat, didn't you? Yeah. That you say that, you're absolutely right. We did, he had sent us all, this is back in my Got Mead Live show days, where we would get meads from different meaderies. And one of the ones that we did get from, it was such an uneventful thing that I don't remember it. But I do remember getting the bottle. I know I drank it.
The one he makes, the one that Frank Golbeck makes, is called Sauvage Bois. And I was laughing at JD because he kept calling it Savage Boys.
Yeah.
I thought that sounds like an 80s rock band.
Yeah. It kind of does.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah, I do recall.
It's interesting that we went here early in the show. I actually started a 3-gallon batch of sour mead back on, checking my book here, back on February 4th. I used a 3-gallon batch. Y yeast, used their Belgian lambic blend, and you know, thought it was interesting, wanted to give it a shot. It's one of those that I put in the carboy, and I'm not going to touch it for a year. And I, you know, we talked about how those traditional style sours can pick up different flavors and characters over time. This one said, I was doing a little bit of research, and they said, don't even rack it. Just set it aside. Don't touch it for a year, because sitting on the lease and the spent yeast is going to the bacteria are going to use that and convert that into some really good character. So next September, remind me to give you an update on it.
Yeah.
So did you sneak a taste yet?
I have not. I did it. I did not. It's the first. It has an ale yeast that was part of the smack pack. So what I had to do was, it recommended as well, because if it was to put in, I lost my page here. Maltodextrin, so that the sure. yeast. Yeah. The yeast can't convert it, but that'll let the sour kind of go to town on it a little bit later. So, you know, I'm trying to just keep it sealed up, keep it in the closet, not touch it. So I haven't tasted it all yet, because there really wasn't anything going on when I put the airlock on it.
Sure. Well, it's an interesting addition for the maltodextrin. I know, because it doesn't get used by yeast, you typically see small additions in the beer world, so you get a little bit more, like, it helps with the body of the beer, but it doesn't add a lot of, like, perceptible sugar mash. So I find it interesting that the bacteria can chew on that, the yeast can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, to be able to sit on that stuff for a year without even touching it, I've got some wine going here too, and I've got one it's going to be really hard to stay out of the carboy. I almost feel like putting it in a locked closet and giving the key to my neighbor, to make sure I stay out of it. So it's kind of got to be a hard thing to do, isn't it? Keep your fingers out of the bottle.
Well, the key is you keep your wine rack full, so that you pull what you need off of it. You're not worried about what's not in the bottle yet.
Yeah, and I got a pretty full one at that. So, like I said, my cardiologist a while back told me that I need to be drinking at least one glass of red wine a day. So that's when I started my winemaking hobby.
And JD, the more is better kind of guy. So
I do exactly what my doctor says. So,
if one is good, six is great.
Yeah. Right. But this sour mead thing, I don't think it's a wildly, I don't think a lot of people are doing it, but I've seen it out there. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that one that we got from Frank Goldbeck at her Gold Coast, I can't remember it. I remember getting the bottle, but it probably was something that I didn't particularly care for, because it's just, I don't have any, I didn't file away any memories of it. Now, he's got a couple others that I really liked. But that particular one, I don't know. I mean, just, maybe the sour part that I don't agree with or didn't agree with me, but interesting that they would put it over into the beer side of the world too, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely not for everybody, and I know the sourness protocols definitely come from that beer side of the world, whether it's like the Belgian lambics or some of the other sour beers that are coming out now. But yeah, no, you do take some risks when you're doing anything sour, whether it's a meat or a beer or whatever, just because basically that the equipment you're using with that is almost assuredly permanently contaminated with that bacteria. So you can really only do sours unless you're going to go through really exhaustive sanitization protocols. It's easier just to say, you know, this is now the sour tank and leave it at that.
Well, that's why some of the breweries have started doing that kettle souring, so that mm-hmm. they can have a sour in their lineup without contaminating the rest of their brewery or equipment.
Right.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, most of Frank's meads are made in sort of a beer style anyway. They're very lower gravity and carbonated and so that probably lends itself well to that.
Yeah, and I'm surprised at the way, now typically, you know, I mean, even in my younger life, I mean, I didn't drink the Pepsis and the Cokes and all that kind of stuff. I just, you know, didn't like them, didn't care for them. And I'm not much on, you know, carbonated drinks like, carbonated wines. I don't like champagne, that kind of thing. About the only thing carbonated that I really, truly drink is beer. But the very few carbonated meads that I've had, I've kind of enjoyed. And I really like that one from Aaron, that Braggot that he sent. I really like that. And that's what kind of put me on the path of this whole Braggot thing, really. It's Aaron's fault. We can talk about him because he's not here. But the, while we're on the subject, we can bring everybody up to date on where we're at with our projects. Mine's already in the hopper. It's been there since the 6th, which is, a few days ago. Hell, I don't even have a calendar on my wall. When you're retired, you just don't give a damn what day it is anymore or what time it is. But, it's a kit, a bourbon barrel, porter kit. That I got from Northern Brewer, and it's 1 pound of English chocolate and malt, a half a pound of English dark crystal, half pound of, and that's, I'm just reading down the list here, half a pound of English black malt, 2 pounds of wheat malt DME, 6.3 pounds of dark malt syrup, 1 ounce of Chinook hops and 1 ounce of Golding's hops. And I just, you know, I followed the directions, made the beer basically. And, after I put the immersion chiller in and got it cold, chilled down, and in the hopper, that's when I added the honey. And I put 6 pounds. Six pounds, 8 ounces, 6.5 pounds of honey, wildfire honey in it. I wanted to go the full 8, but I was still fearful because my yeast choice is Nottingham. I use Nottingham yeast. But I was still fearful that, perhaps all that sugar just might not be what that yeast could stand to have all at one shot. So I held back the 2 pounds. So it's not a true Braggot, Jeff, because obviously all of the malt adds up to just a little over 8 pounds. But it's in the hopper. It's been turning away. It smells good. It smells like a beer. Be interesting to see where it turns out. So that's what's going on at the mead house here.
Now, are you measuring your percentages by weight or by contribution to gravity?
By weight. Everything that went in was by weight. The honey was by weight. But I also kind of knew where, based, and this goes back to Patty Mackey, bless her heart. She was right on the money with that 35 points. And I know we talked about it after the last show, but she was right on the money. She anticipated something around 1.100 with 6 pounds of honey added to this particular brew. And when it was all done and over with, I came out with 1.111. So, you know, you can't argue with that. And I, you know, when it hit there, I thought, you know what, that's it. No more honey. You know, let's get the yeast in it, get it going. I just didn't want to risk it, you know.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this Irish Red Ale here. This is a kit from Northern Brewer, and it's the Irish Red Ale with specialty grains. It's an extract kit with specialty grains. And so the malt extract that comes with it is 6 pounds of gold malt syrup. And the specialty grains, it has a 0.5 pound of Belgian Cara 8. It has a 0.25 pound of Breeze Special Roast, and an 1/8 pound each of Belgian Biscuit and English Chocolate Malt. So that's a total of 1 pound of specialty grains. The kit comes with 1 ounce of Willamette hops and 1 ounce of U.S. Goldings. Now, I've decided to change the hop profile for this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use East Kent Goldings for the last part of the boil for the aroma, more or less. And then I'm going to use Cascade. I think, let me look at my notes here. I wrote down what I was going to do. Chinook. Excuse me. I'm going to use Chinook and East Kent Goldings for this. The original gravity of the kit is 1044. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use blackberry honey, and I'm going to add the honey up to a gravity of about 1098. And I'm going to ferment it with a red ale, an Irish ale yeast. That's not the one that comes with the kit. So I'm either going to use a Y yeast or a White Labs. I think I'm going to go with the Y yeast because I've used some of theirs before. So I'm going to be changing up the hop profile, changing up the yeast. I really don't understand why this kit is an Irish ale kit and it doesn't come with an Irish ale yeast. I don't understand why, but they only give you the choices with the kit of either a Nottingham, a West Coast ale, or an American ale. I don't really understand why that is, but anyway, those are the changes I'm going to make to this kit that I'm using.
And you were saying before the show, your kit comes in on Thursday, right?
Yeah, should be here Thursday. So maybe this will go in Thursday night, maybe Friday. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
So anyway, on the way I'm going to do the hops, I'm going to do 60 minutes with the Chinook, 1.7 ounces. That'll give me 50 IBUs. Then I'm going to do another 3/4 ounce at for 20 minutes. That'll give me another 10 IBUs. And then I'm going to do 2 1/4 ounces of the Kent Golding hops for the last 5 minutes, and that'll give me 5 IBUs. So I'm looking at a total of 65 IBUs on this. the Irish ale yeast that I'm going to use should take this completely dry. And it probably, maybe, might have enough gumption left to carbonate it if I wanted to bottle condition it, which I think I want to do just because of tradition on this one. I don't want to really go with kegging on it just because, well, I just haven't done a bottle condition in a very long time. So I want to do that. So taking into account that this may not have enough left in the yeast to carbonate it, I'm thinking about probably tossing in a little something like maybe some EC1118 into the bottling bucket when I mix in my priming sugar. Just to make sure that there's enough viable yeast there to carbonate.
Yeah, it doesn't take much, does it?
No, not much. And you know, I may even end up using some of those carbonation drops, which is sort of it's a little thing like a jelly bean that has a little bit of sugar and a little bit of yeast already measured out for you for each bottle, and you just drop one in each bottle. I've never used those, but might be a good time to try them.
You know, I've used those once, and I found it gave me too much carbonation for a 12-ounce bottle. Try it at your own risk. You may like that level of carbonation. You may not.
Mm-hmm. So, well, what do you mean? Like when you pop the top, it blows a hole in the ceiling or something, or what?
You pop off a cap, and it turns into a champagne bottle, kind of. Get that nice foamy head spilling out the top.
Yeah, oh, I don't want that. I think I may may go a different direction. I may stick with the old dextrose and do it that way. So, but yeah. You can sprinkle a little EC1118 or something like that. There's no way that 11 or 12% mead's gonna not carbonate with EC1118. So
yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, interesting. I wonder why. Or do you know, maybe somebody else here at the table knows, but I mean, this yeast that you wanted to use that doesn't come with the kit that you wanted to use. I mean, what's the difference between using that and a Nottingham? I mean, what's the difference between using an Irish ale? Is there something in particular about that yeast that lends a different profile?
It's the one that was isolated from the Irish ales, I'm assuming. You got to remember, when you start talking about brewing beer, you're getting way out of my league. This is something that I know very little about, but I'm going to make the assumption that it's the same thing that you encounter with mead. You get very different flavor profiles from different yeasts in mead, and I've got to assume it's the same with beer and everything else that you brew.
Have you ever had an Irish ale? Have you had a red Irish ale beer?
Oh, yeah. I've made an Irish ale Braggot before one time, but it's been...
No, I mean a beer, just a straight beer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but there again, I'm not one to ask about properties and qualities of it because I'm not a beer drinker. So, I can taste a mead and I can tell you what's good, what's bad, what needs to change, and give you an honest opinion on it. With beer, there's so many different kinds of beer that just, to me, they're just beer. And I just don't have the palate for, I'm just not a beer drinker. So, if you can't appreciate it, why brew it a lot?
Yeah.
Well, and I'm no expert in this field myself, but from what I've heard, the Nottingham yeast is kind of a general English ale yeast that tends to leave a little bit more residual sweetness. It tends to have some of those fruity phenolics that I don't think the the Irish ale yeast brings to the table. I think the Irish ale yeast, from the limited experience I've had with it, tends to be a little bit cleaner ferment. It tends to be a little bit smoother ferment without any kind of the fusels or the phenolics and some of the off flavors that you get with other yeasts.
Yeah, and the Irish ale yeast that Y yeast makes says it's good up to 12%, so that should take care of the additional honey as well without kicking out before it's time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that Nottingham yeast is a pretty popular yeast with all the cider makers, the hard cider brewers. Out there, homebrewtalk.com is a pretty good resource for cider. You know, if you want information on brewing ciders, and of course it's the premier beer brewing website. But I've used that Nottingham before in hard ciders, and came out pretty good. I'm not quite sure how it differs from anything else, but. I've had pretty decent luck with it.
I was actually just on the Northern Brewer website, and I was looking at these different yeasts and everything, and I noticed they've got this small batch hard cider, hard apple cider starter kit, and it's hellish expensive. It's $70 for a 1 gallon.
Oh, wow.
Starter kit, yeah, and
wow.
that comes with a small fermenter, a 1 gallon jug, a couple of airlocks. It's got a little mini siphon, bottle caps, bottle capper. It's still a little bit expensive for a 1 gallon kit, but
yeah.
Anyway, I was looking on here to see if it told what kind of yeast they include with it, but I'm not seeing it actually. But anyway, it's called the Crooked Apple Hard Cider Starter Kit. Now, if you look down further, they've got the exact same thing, only it's just the juice itself, and it's $30. For a 1 gallon, that's still, say 10 bottles, maybe that's $3 a bottle. So that's still kind of steep, I think. But it's kind of interesting looking at it. I don't mean to get off the braggot subject, but while I was looking at this, I just wanted to throw it out here. It says it has, it contains apple juice concentrate. So this is not 1 gallon of apple juice. This is a gallon of apple juice concentrate, and no added sugar. It finishes out at 6% ABV.
And it only makes a gallon?
It only makes a gallon. So they're using apple juice concentrate entirely for the whole thing, it would appear. And... let's see here. I found this was quite interesting. They do include the fizz drops with this, the little carbonation drops. And they include the stabilizer with it. But if you want to sweeten it, they've got a sweetener packet. Now, this is kind of, this is sort of a neat idea, something I haven't really thought about. But if you want to sweeten something, and you still want to be able to bottle condition it, they're using an artificial sweetener. So maybe something like stevia or something like that would be good to sweeten up a little bit and not be fermentable. That's something I haven't really thought about. I thought that was kind of a neat idea. It might taste like crap. I don't know.
Is that like, is that stuff that artificial sweet? I mean, you're talking about the same stuff that you find in restaurants in those little blue and yellow packages. I mean, it's the same stuff, right?
Oh, no.
Well,
stevia is actually.
Yeah.
Stevia is actually it's derived from a plant called stevia, and it doesn't have the same characteristics as sugar, being, you know, it's not as weighty. It doesn't act the same in recipes, so you kind of have to cut it with sugar. But it is a very tricks you into believing something is very sweet when it's not, just by adding a small amount of the powdered leaves of this plant.
I found with stevia is that it doesn't have the chemical sweetener taste that something like NutraSweet.
That's what I was just going to say, because some of that stuff, I don't even say how people put it in their coffee. It tastes like crap. I mean, it tastes like chemical.
It does.
Right.
I find stevia can still be a little bit cloyingly sweet, but it doesn't have that chemically taste to it.
Yeah, and another thing to remember about stevia is it's like 10 times sweeter than table sugar, so it doesn't take a whole lot. But because it is a natural extract from a leaf, it doesn't have that chemical nature to it that the other sweeteners have.
Stevia, I've heard of it. I'll have to look for it.
But I think you would probably have to be careful if you bought it for that purpose, because some of the stevia is actually cut with table sugar. And occasionally you can find stevia that's pure. I think there's a brand called Truvia that's actually pure stevia. It doesn't contain any sucrose.
Well, since we've transitioned over to the cider thing, I kind of like the idea. That's a whole different approach. Chris talking about the condensed, or, you know, whatever, what is it called?
Concentrate.
Jesus, don't get old. I wonder if that's the same thing as, you know, the stuff you find in the frozen cans, Chris. Get a dozen or whatever it takes to fill a gallon jug and just drop some yeast in it. I mean, you were talking something along the same lines, you think?
You know, I'm wondering if it's actually pure concentrate, or if it just is the majority. They probably used concentrate and then adjusted it with water to get the proper starting gravity, whatever 6% ABV would require. That would be my guess.
I would make that assumption too. That sounds safe.
Yeah, because I think probably pure concentrate would probably be a bit too much. So they probably just cut it down to the proper starting gravity. The reason I looked at it in the first place was to see if it listed the kinds of apples they used, but it didn't. So who knows what kind it is. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's just like the little cans of frozen apple juice concentrate. I mean, you have no idea what kind of apples are in it. You know, it just says 100% apple juice, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I would assume it's probably not real cider apples, being that it's a U.S. product. They have another brand called Cider House, but it's all they're almost always sold out. So I've never seen those in stock.
Wow,
it's actually much more affordable. It's like a 6-gallon kit for $50.
I actually made the Cider House kit last fall. Found one of the, they have a pear flavor variety that I found really nice. And I highly recommend the Cider House kits. They gave me excellent results. And from what I've heard, my local homebrew store says they're pretty consistent with really good quality cider. So if you can find them in stock, absolutely try it out. Get them and, you know, make yourself some good cider.
Ryan, do you ever get into? Oh, go ahead, Chris. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh no, I was going to say the Cider House brand is it's in stock in the pear and the pomegranate apple.
I like pomegranate.
The regular apple has been out of stock every time I looked.
Try, Chris, the Midwest Supplies website. They have a lot of that stuff too. And actually, I'm on there right now, and this is spiced. Sorry, they've got the pear cider, the spiced cider, and you know, wouldn't you know it, that the original apple cider is out of stock. But I wonder if you could get spiced cider. I don't know if you can, if the spices are, if you add those or not.
Does it list a, sometimes, like Northern Brewer, they've got actually a PDF of the same thing they send you in the kit. It tells you, it's all the instructions, all the ingredients. I might look and see if there's a list of instructions or whatever that comes with it. But, Ryan, have you done any cider work at all? Have you?
You know, I before we get too far off track, should I jump back?
We're already there. All right. We're down a completely different road now. But yeah, talk about your braggot.
So I did the. I guess I don't know what to call it yet. So it's TBD. But remember, we're going to start with the Beauchet braggot. I took 6 pounds of wildflower honey, and I boiled it on the stove for 40 and 45 minutes until I got that toasted marshmallow aroma from it, which was what I was looking for. And then I added 6 pounds of dark malt syrup, and then. The kit that I was working off of came with cluster hops, and you know that it recommended 60 minutes on. I switched those out and went with Columbus hops. Had a little bit of a higher alpha acid, and I thought with everything else we were doing that might work a little bit better. Then I did use the Cascade hops that were included in the kit for 20 minutes. And then I had the quarter pound of roasted barley and the quarter pound of chocolate malt, cold brewing or cold steeping, and then added those to the fermenter once everything was at room temperature. That got me to, and I added the Cefal US05 ale yeast, and that's been chugging right along. I got that all pitched on Sunday. The question that I don't know, because I, you know, Chris, just like you, I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm gonna work this ale yeast as hard as I can. You know, I'm gonna use some of our mead making techniques, and I've done a staggered additions of Fermate O and been degassing it just to try to help that yeast chug along. And then I did want to bottle condition it, so I was thinking the same thing. Let's use a little 1118 that we know can handle that alcohol content when we bottle condition. The one variable for me is that we don't know, we've got 1090 as the original gravity, but we don't know where, or how much of the sugar we made unfermentable when we, boiled it, or when I boiled it. I'm using the collective we here a lot, but, when I boiled that down, you know, and even in that dark malt syrup, there could be some unfermentable sugar. So I'm not exactly sure where it's going to end up, but we will see. You know, and a lot of the breweries around here, is to go off on a side note here, a lot of the breweries that have restaurants around here have this stuff called brewer's bread, you know, where they take the spent grains and they mix that in with their bread dough, you know, or as part of their bread dough, and you know, that you get a nice brewer's bread from it, they call it. Well, I didn't want any bread. I wanted a cookie. So I took the roasted barley and chocolate malt, and I added a scoop of that to a double chocolate cookie recipe I was making. And it kind of gave it a little bit of a coffee note, which was nice. I think you just got to be careful how much you add and at what if it's real grainy or how fine of a grind you got on it.
Yeah, and so you didn't do anything else to the grain, just right out of the bag into your cookie dough.
Yeah, it was crushed. I had the crushed the grain went into a strainer bag, and that strainer bag was used. Yeah, I got all in my 1 gallon.
Did we drop them?
Nicole? You know, I'm glad you brought that issue up about you were following standard mead making practices, because that's actually something that I was thinking about this past week with this kit. Was how am I going to handle the fermentation process? I've got my process nailed down for mead making. I would also follow that same process if I were making wine, but with this being a beer or a beer base, hybrid mead, whatever you want to call it, I was just asking myself, how am I going to do this? Am I going to aerate, you know, for the first one third of the ferment and degas daily for the first 7 days and then air lock it? Or am I going to be doing more harm than good? Because I know beer brewers probably would never, ever do that. So what are your guys' opinion on that? How are you going to handle, are you going to do this like it's a mead, or are you going to treat it like it's a beer fermenting? Cause I really haven't decided yet how to do it, because the first time that I made this long time ago, I wasn't taking notes at that time. I hadn't learned that I should be. So I don't remember.
I treated mine like a mead. I've been stirring, degassing, and, you know, the 2448, toasting a thing with Fermade K and DAP. In fact, today's, it'll get the last feeding tonight. That's how I've been doing it. I don't feed the beer, but I stir the beer, not necessarily to degas it, but I stir it, every day. Not a wild stir, but just a stir to keep the yeast suspended. But the braggot, I'm treating it just like a mead. Jeff, what are you doing with yours?
Well, yeah, the higher gravity, I think you have to make some accommodations there. So I've been doing the nutrient additions, 24, 48, 72, and then the 1/3 sugar break. I stir it a little bit, but I try not to stir it very much because I wasn't as worried about degassing this time around as much as just you get that really nasty head from all the carbonation popping up, and it's a mess to get the lid back on the bucket. So I basically, you know, I stirred to incorporate those the must with the nutrients in it into the must itself, or I just stirred it a little bit to keep everything mixed up, you know, get the hops off the top and back mixed into the must, keep the yeast in suspension like you said. And I didn't do too much with it. I tried to keep it a gentle stir at that, really.
Yeah. And Ryan's doing his just like a mead, it sounds like, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, because the higher gravity, they're going to need that stirring and agitation and degassing to keep the stress level down. And Jeff, you just mentioned something that I was going to say as a little tip to people listening. A lot of people, when they add nutrients, regardless if it's a mead, braggot, or whatever, you know, you hear all these horror stories about having these big eruptions and a lot of people go to a lot of trouble to remove some of the must, and they mix the nutrients in with it and then add it back in. You can avoid a lot of work and mess there doing that if you'll simply just do your degassing first. I've never had an eruption like that or any sort of violent reaction by degassing first. Then add your dry nutrients right in. And usually what I do, I use a drill-mounted stirrer. And so once I've got it degassed, I will just keep the drill running on low and keep the must moving as I sprinkle the nutrients in. And I've never had a problem with it. So rather than going to all the trouble of trying to pull out some must and mix it in and put it back and all that, try that sometime. It'll save you a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I have, my drill mount doesn't work on my 1 gallon fermenters, which I've been using a lot of the last couple weeks, and so I've had to go back to decanting a little bit and mixing that in, just because my main degassing at this point is a food saver.
Get you a 2 gallon 2 gallon bucket from Lowe's or Home Depot to do your 1 gallon batches in. They're perfect. They're just like the 5 gallons, but they're 2 gallon, and you know, you can set those up and problem solved.
Yeah, I don't even use I don't use glass though. I've got a ton of 1 gallon glass carboys, but I've got another thing you can do if you got a kitchen place. You know, I'm lucky. I've got a kitchen supply place right up the street. I get these 8-quart food containers that has pretty much an airtight lid on it. And I just drill a hole through the top big enough to put a grommet in and an airlock. And that's what I use for my 1 gallon stuff to ferment that, in.
Exactly what I did. As a matter of fact, Walmart has those 2 gallon. Food grade buckets back in the sink section, they've got the lids with the little gasket inside, so they are airtight. And you just drill a hole in the lid, put a little grommet in there, and it requires a 9/16 hole, I believe. And then put your grommet in, and your airlock goes in that. And then you use your glass jugs, your glass carboys for your secondary, your 1 gallon jugs.
Yeah.
And that'll allow you to make melomels and everything there with all the fruit and stuff in the 2 gallon bucket.
Easy cleanup.
Yeah.
Easy to clean up.
Yeah, because I've tried digging fruit out of a smallmouth gallon jug before.
I just throw the jug away.
It's bad enough in a 5 gallon carboy, but try it in a 1 gallon jug.
That's what I did. The very first big mead that I did was that orange blossom thing. I still got bottles of it. In fact, I should break one out. And it's almost it's probably over 2 years now, but. I stuffed a bunch of oranges down that, you know, little 1-inch hole on the top of a 5 gallon carboy.
Oh, jeez.
You know, I didn't even think, you know, I mean, it's all done. Now I got to rack it into a clean carboy. And then the next thing I'm, you know, funny, what do you do with all the frickin' oranges in the bottom of this carboy? You know,
The first time I did that, I gave up on trying to dig them all out. And, so I pulled the old, high school science, project trick where you put a balloon inside the carboy, you hold on to the end and you tilt it up. And when the orange slice gets in front of the balloon, you blow the balloon up and pull it out and it pulls the orange slice with it.
There you go.
And if you had seen me doing that, you would have had pictures of that posted all over the website. it was just this big fiasco that, and when I finished that, I said, I will never, ever put fruit in a carboy ever again.
I just I was able to find, here's another thing. Go look around your house and see if you got any metal, the little wire coat hangers. I bet you don't. But I managed to find one in the house, and I just cut it apart and then made a hook on one end and, you know, turned the bottle upside down and fished them out. But
I use metal coat hangers to rig up all kind of stuff all the time. And you know, actually my very first drill mounted degasser was a plastic coat hanger that I held over a boiling kettle.
Mine too.
And I cut it and I bent it with steam and made a drill mounted degasser.
Yep. I did the same. In fact, I still got it. And in fact, I use it in my 1 gallon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
The reason I did it was because the one that I bought would not fit into a 1 gallon jug. And the way that I used to make mead was I would start the fermentation in a bucket and I would let it finish in the jug. I've since changed that process, but I couldn't get anything in there to degas. So I made that out of a plastic coat hanger and it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. I did the same thing. And then, you know, when I learned, when I, you know, stopped doing anything in a glass carboy, I just cut it in half. And it fits just fine in my 2 gallon food container. So another DIY project. Hey, you know, you don't have to go out there and spend $30 on one of these fancy dancy stirring sticks. You can do the same thing with a plastic coat hanger and accomplish the same thing. So,
yeah. Well, you know, I live by this rule. If you don't have the money to buy this stuff, if you want to bad enough, you can find a way to make it. If you do have plenty of money, that's no reason to spend it, because there's always a chance that you may be able to take it with you. So, yeah. You know, we just don't know yet.
So, JD, you were talking about ciders there with, you know, two or three tangents ago. What I like doing is when I'm experimenting is I'll make a 5 or 6 gallon base batch, and then I'll break that off into 1 gallon batches and add, adjuncts or you know, flavor them up. So I was thinking about this and I am going to do a 5 gallon base batch of Sizer. I think it said cider, but I'm going to do a, you know, Sizer and then, do a few different, throw some things in each of the 1 gallons. And in one of them, you know, I'm going to do a vanilla bean and have kind of this, I'm not sure yet if I'm going to do cinnamon or if it's going to be straight vanilla or a vanilla cinnamon. Maybe both. I mean, you know, sure. What the hell, you know, it's only a gallon. And then, in one of them, I was going to add, ginger, and in another one, maybe a little tart cherry juice, maybe 4 ounces or so. And kind of create, you know, these different, it's also nice, I think, when you've got a variety to pick from, whether it's for yourself or whether you're entertaining guests and you've got, you know, you sure look classy when you can offer people a variety of stuff you've made.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty good idea. What kind of juice do you typically use? Just stuff right out of the store or?
I'm typically using stuff out of the store here. There are a lot of orchards here in Minnesota. You know, I was doing a lot of research after one of the shows a month ago now or whatever time we first talked. There are so many apple varieties that have been tailored to fit, you know, the different climates, that the first apples here, I mean, I think are ready in July. And then they, you know, there's different, there's some ready in July, some in August. I mean, all the way through October, they're constantly, you know, being ready. And, you know, Chris, you know, we were talking about crab apples. A couple of the orchards here, and I was going through all the different varieties they have. They've got, sweet crab apples, two or three different varieties of sweet crab apples that are actually just fine for eating. And I thought, well, that defeats the whole purpose of what we were going after with crab apples.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of such a thing.
You're looking for something bitter and astringent.
Yeah, exactly. And here are these, you know, it says that they're sweet crab apples, just even good for eating. Just fine for table eating.
That's a bastardization of crab apples. That's not.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's not crab apples. If you can pick one and eat it without cringing, it's not a crab apple.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wow.
You can probably thank the University of Minnesota for that. You know, the University of Minnesota's got a lot of the big agriculture department. You know, they created, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the first corn that could be grown in a short growing season in northern climate. You know, they created some of the grapes that are able to mature quickly that the vineyards here use. You know, they created the Honeycrisp apple. You know, so
GMO stuff.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah, GMO. I'm sure they're the ones that also decided that we needed sweet crab apples.
Well, yeah, you know, when you walk, I mean, I do this, I walk through the produce. I mean, the store that I shop at is huge. It's just, it's a massive place. And, they've got a huge produce section, and I go walking through it, and, you know, it's like the middle of July. It's like 110 degrees outside. And here's this huge bin of red apples of all kinds of various varieties. And I'm thinking, where the hell do these apples come from? Why, you know, I mean, come on. We're like 4 months away from apple season here. Where in the hell are these apples coming from? You know?
There's certain varieties of apples can, you know, stored at the right temperature are fine for a year.
Well, and that's the trouble I have. I mean, I've ranted about it before on the show about, you know, I absolutely hate getting fruit from the store because the stuff is picked so damn early. I bought three peaches the other day and brought them home. And of course, they're hard as baseballs. So I set them out on the kitchen table for, they sat there for 2 days. And, you know, I picked them up. Okay, there's, you know, skin's feeling pretty soft. You know, it's time to slice them up. And generally, I slice them all the way around. And then you can twist them and, you know, twist them apart. You just twist them. Well, I twisted and twisted and twisted until I just completely almost mangled one peach. And I thought, you know, what is this? So I started carving it up with a knife, but the outside is nice and soft and moist, and the inside, hard as a rock, you know? And I, what the hell do you do with this, you know? By the time you can eat the damn thing, the outside is going to be dry and useless before the inside even gets ripe. And that's what I hate about getting fruit from the store. All this stuff is picked so damn early. And it's hard to find. I mean, you're pretty much, you know, relegated to finding, you know, going to the frozen food section and buying frozen fruit. You know, because, you know, that stuff is going to be somewhat ripe, you know, when they put it in the bag.
Yeah, I found recently that frozen fruit tends to be more ripe and better quality than the fresh produce in most grocery stores. And if we're looking at mead making and wine making, things like the Vintner's Harvest, those things are canned specifically for winemaking, so they are at the peak ripeness.
Well, you know, funny you should say that because, you know, I've been down every year. I used to go down to the produce house in L.A. and get 100 pounds of tomatoes to make my sauce with every year. So I talked to the guys down there. I know what's going on. And you see these buyers. You'd think you were going to a swimsuit modeling frickin' thing. The way some of these buyers look at the fruit, I mean, they're looking for stuff that's just absolutely perfect and presentable. And I mean, this is how it winds up on your shelf in your store. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, so yeah, the stuff they put in bags, I suspect, Chris, that those are the culls. Those are the ones that slipped through the little hole. Maybe it was too small. Maybe it was overripe, according to, the need for the store. But, you know, I suppose you're probably right, you know.
Yeah, and another thing I've noticed lately, we have quite a few farmers markets around near me. And it used to be that if you went to the farmers market, it was actually the farmers. They brought in, usually the things that they had for sale were picked that day. Yeah. And they had, whatever they had, peas, okra, tomatoes, different fruits and things like that. I've noticed now that a lot of the farmers markets, the people who are selling there, they're not even the farmers. They're people who have gone, they've gone and they've bought up who knows what from who knows where. And it's basically the same thing that's in the supermarket.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know, that's the mark of a good farmers market. You know, in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis farmers market is that way. You've got people selling, Dole brand bananas, there's not a banana grown in 1,000 miles of Minneapolis. But then the St. Paul farmers market, in Minneapolis and St. Paul being the twin cities. If you want a booth at the St. Paul farmers market, you've got to have a farm or a facility, depending, if you're a honey, maybe you produce honey or something, within, I think, 50 or 60 miles of St. Paul. And one of the members of that farmer's market actually goes out there and verifies that everything on your application is accurate about you, being the operator of this local, farm.
That's a good thing.
Yep. And it's the same way in Kansas City. The big farmers market here, the big city market, has a bunch of the perimeter of the market has a bunch of like these permanent building stalls with what I refer to as fruit resellers or produce resellers. And you've got a handful of, dedicated farmers that just basically bring their own tables and set up their wares kind of in the middle. But there are a number of smaller, like, the neighborhoods or the small suburbs all have their own farmers markets, and most of them have that same kind of a locally sourced produce caveat in their applications where, it has to be within 50 or 100 miles and locally produced and this, that, or the other. You have to be a savvy shopper and kind of avoid the larger farmers markets in favor of the smaller, more community-focused ones around here.
Yeah.
I remember the days when you could stop at the farmer's market and you could find someone and say you wanted purple hull peas or something, and you could find someone who had some, and you could say, I'd like to get 2 bushels of those. Can you have those? Yeah, I think I can get 2 bushels for you. Stop by tomorrow and I'll have them. Can you stop back by the same time tomorrow, and he's got you 2 bushels of peas picked ready for you?
Yeah.
You know that stuff was grown on his farm and was picked that day. He went home and picked it for you. That's fresh produce. That's what a farmer's market should be like. It's getting harder and harder to find.
Well, it's, you know, a lot of the thing about, you know, these farmers markets is it's the nostalgia of the thing, you know. You're going out and you're seeing produce being presented to you in a raw form. It's not all dressed up and dolled up like it. I mean, I'm not kidding you. To talk to these guys down at the produce house, I'm not kidding. You'd think you were going to a swimsuit competition for a magazine. The way these people look at the fruit, I mean, it's just got to be a just certain way and have a certain look before they put it on the shelf. Because that's what sells. But if you go to the farmer's market, you know, that same apple, it's not covered in wax. You know, it's presented in its raw form. It looks like it came right off the tree. That's the kind of stuff I like to buy, you know. And you can spot that stuff at farmer's markets. We get the same thing up here. Now, there's no farms within 100 miles where I live. Okay, it's like, you know, like Ryan was saying about bananas. But there are farms that are several, you know, 150, 200 miles north, and they do, they start out early in the morning and they bring their stuff down to these farmers markets. And, you know, they're pretty much certified. And a lot of the stuff is organic, which is something else you got to be careful of, but at least the product that they're bringing, the fruits that they're bringing, I mean, it's being presented to you in a natural raw form. I mean, if you want a ripe peach, go to a farmer's market, you know, because their peaches are ripe. You can eat them that day. And that's the kind of stuff that I wanted to put in my bucket, Chris, you know, when I did my peach, melomel that's still working here. But, you know, so.
Well, you know, we got on this subject because Ryan brought up his sizer he was going to do.
Yeah.
I've pretty much narrowed mine down to 2, and I think I'm going to do both of them. One is the apple pie that I was talking about before on the other show, which is basically just a straight sizer, and then in secondary you add vanilla and cinnamon. The second one that I'm going to do is going to be a blueberry sizer. And it's much more complicated, I guess. It's got some lees aging and aging in the primary bucket and then more lees aging in the secondary. So, and then we've got an oak addition after that. So, I think I'm going to do both of them. One's fairly straightforward and simple. The other's a little more involved, but you end up with 2 very different drinks. And I'm just going to do these. You know, I like to have a sizer for winter, especially for the holidays. But I think I'm just going to do these with next year in mind, with the next winter and next holiday season, because they're not going to be ready for this one for sure. So,
are you using juice or real blueberries, or a combination?
I'm going to use frozen blueberries. That's going to be my best option, unless I decide to go with the Vintner's Harvest. Probably, I really think I'm just going to go with frozen blueberries because I want to get those skins in there.
Hello.
Yeah, you're here, Ryan. We got you. Oh, now we lost him again. Ryan having a difficult time getting connected here. We keep dropping it for some reason. We'll keep working on Ryan here. But,
Is he back? You guys hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
I'm back, yeah.
Yeah, you're back. Go ahead.
Chris was talking about oaking his blueberry sizer, and then you guys all left me.
Yeah.
Well, the apple pie gets nothing but vanilla and cinnamon. The blueberry gets aging on the skins, aging on the leaves, and then it gets oaked. And it's a more drawn-out process, but I think it's going to be worth it. And you know, when I first started making sizers, my go-to source of information was anything that Pete Bakalich had posted about sizers. Pete had gotten on this kick with sizers for a long time, and he came up with some very interesting sizer recipes. And the blueberries sizer was one of his, and I've taken it and made a few changes, not very many, but just a few things that suit my style of mead making a little bit more. I don't think it's going to drastically change the end result, but that's where the inspiration for that one. The inspiration for the apple pie came from Michael Fairbrother, so I want to make sure I give credit for, you know, who came up with all these. I didn't come up with them. So Michael and Pete, I'm going to steal your recipes this year.
And the flavors, you know, we had talked about or spent some time talking about the pumpkin thing and how, you know, it may be that you really don't need to throw cans of pumpkin or roasted pumpkin into the mix. Using the pumpkin spice may be really all you need to accomplish that. You know, I mean, I guess the same thing could be said for this apple pie sizer, huh, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it just, it's simple. If you make a good sizer to start with, then whatever you do as an adjunct is going to, you know, that's the direction it's going to take it. But no matter how good your vanilla and cinnamon and or whatever else you put in, you've got to make a good sizer. And that comes down to, of course, we've already talked about, we don't have ideal conditions to get sizer apples. So we work with the best that we can get and work with what we have. But it all comes down to good mead making practice, temperature control, nutrient additions, aeration, degassing. I mean, how many hundred times have we gone over that? It just most anything that you want to make, once you get your base recipe down, if you follow good mead making practices, your product's going to come out good. It's just a matter of learning how to create that proper balance in your flavors.
What's your guys' thoughts on using spices? You know, typically these kits, they come with, there goes Jeff. Did we lose Jeff too?
Jeff, you there?
If I get Jeff, I'll see if I can get Jeff back. But
I think it's about quitting time.
yeah, briefly. I mean, let's give a couple of minutes to the spice aspect of this whole thing. Are you using whole spices, or are you using the spices that come in a McCormick's bottle?
For the apple pie, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm using fresh vanilla beans and cinnamon sticks. I remember Michael talking about that he used a Vietnamese cinnamon for his. So I'm going to track down some Vietnamese cinnamon, and I can't remember the type of vanilla bean he used. I've got it in an email somewhere that he sent me. I'll have to look back. If I can't find it, I'll have to get in touch with him and find out what kind. But I do remember it was a Vietnamese cinnamon.
Vietnamese, yeah. And nutmeg, do you use the whole... I always, when I cook, I use the whole nutmeg,
I'm not using nutmeg in this. It's simply just cinnamon and vanilla. But if I were going to use nutmeg, I would use a whole nutmeg and just coarsely crush it.
Yeah. Jeff, you back?
Yeah, I think so.
There he is. Okay.
You clocked out too
dropping
early.
Everybody tonight. Yeah, clocking out early, are you? Huh?
I guess it's my turn to drop the call. Jeez.
Ryan, what do you prefer? The whole spice versus the... You know, the and this is not a hack on McCormick's, but for lack of a better, you know, the bottled spices.
Yeah, you know, I like the whole spices as well, and part of the reason is it makes racking so much easier if you've got a whole cinnamon stick in there as opposed to, you know, a teaspoon or a tablespoon of powdered cinnamon. Yeah. You know, which could be in suspension or you know, cause you to just make more effort to try to get it out of there.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think you get a better flavor out of whole? And let's throw it over to Jeff here for a minute real quick before he splits again. Whole spice, do you think you get a better flavor out of it or have better control over the amount of spices that you wind up with? Or what's your take on the whole spice thing?
As far as spices go, my general approach is get them whole and crush them up just really roughly. You just kind of want to open them up, but I try to use them whole until I'm ready to put them in because generally that whole spice holds on to the flavor. It doesn't degrade like ground spice or a kind of a premix spice will all by itself.
Yeah.
So you get more of a true spice aroma that way. You know, I try to source mine as freshly as possible, and I like the flavor of the whole spice.
You know,
it's almost a shame to say this, but I was a young adult before I actually had freshly ground black pepper.
Yeah.
And that's what opened my eyes to fresh spices, you know, because up till that time, I ate my grandmother's cooking. She had the McCormick black pepper shaker in the cabinet, and that's what everything got. Well, you know, then as a young adult, sometime in college, I actually went out to a nice restaurant and had my first freshly ground black pepper. And I didn't know what black pepper tastes like until I tasted it.
Big difference, you huh? Know,
it's a huge, you know, and it's an eye opener. Towards, you know, the culture that I grew up in, that's not what we had. We had, you know, you went and got the McCormick shaker. But then as I got older and started being exposed to more, then when I tasted that, I said, yeah, there's something to this. You know, Emeril Lagasse was right. You know, so
bam.
Emeril became my hero. Yeah. And so it does kick it up a notch, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't have any powdered type pepper in my house either. I mean, everything that I use is as fresh as I can get it. And, you know, I mean, with the exception of that pumpkin beer that I did, of course, the kit came with the pumpkin spices in a little bag. Similar to what you'd get in in the little McCormick shaker bottle. But I used my own pumpkin spice that I had, that I had gotten from one of my spice, places. But of course that's a little bit different ball game there because that's actually thrown in at the end of the boil. So, you're actually spicing up the whole entire liquid at that point with these spices. It's cooked into the, you know, kind of cooked in like you were baking a cake or whatever, you know, versus letting them hang in suspension in a bunch of cold liquid. But I think the preference would be to use, you know, as fresh as you can get. The other thing, I wanted to say something on vanilla before we leave, and I think we've talked about this before, at least I mentioned it. There are, you kind of got to be careful if you're buying whole vanilla beans out there. I mean, there are different beans that come from different places that have different flavors. And you kind of got to be careful. I think the two most common variety out there are the Mexican vanilla bean and the Madagascar vanilla bean. Those are predominantly the two most common. But you get into the Indonesian, you know, some of these other places, and you'd be amazed at how different the vanilla. I mean, it's all vanilla, but, you know, they taste completely different from one another. So it's been kind of fun. I've played around with my own extracts, using different kinds of vanilla beans. And, you know, not that we do any shameless shout outs here, but I got to throw one over to beanilla.com. That's the only place that I buy my vanilla. You know, I order it and 3 days later it's in my mailbox, usually. Beanilla.com.
I was just thinking about that. One time I was ordering some stuff from an online brew. It may have been More Beer or Northern Brewer or somewhere. I don't remember, but they had some a package of three vanilla beans, and I needed some, and I was out, and I thought, yeah, okay, they're cheap. I'm not expecting much, but I'll order them. Turned out to be really, really good quality. And I want to say it was maybe Northern Brewer or Midwest Supply or something like that. So I'll have to look back and see. But they also, they had some really good, very fresh, very strong flavor, good vanilla beans.
Well, and again, you don't have to buy the grade A either, because you will pay a premium price for grade A vanilla beans. You know, if you're going to buy in bulk like I do, get the grade B. It's the same vanilla bean. They've just been sitting around longer. They're not going to lose their flavor. And it's a simple fact of rehydrating. If you just snip the half inch of an end off the bottom end, there's a top and a bottom, snip a half inch off the bottom, stand them up in a little jar of alcohol, vodka, a half inch of vodka on the bottom, just stand them up in a jar and seal it up and let them sit there for about 3 or 4 weeks. And they'll magically turn into grade A vanilla beans, I guarantee it. For use in cooking or, you know, whatever you're going to do with them. So don't waste your money on the grade A. Get the grade B. You're going to pay a whole lot less for them. That's the same damn bean. It's just that the grade B's are just a little more dried out. Some of them are a little bit more brittle than others. But there's an easy remedy for that, like I said. So, guys, we've pretty much reached that point in the show. Man, it was a fun night. I kind of like this free-for-all night, just sitting around a table yakking. We were able to catch up on all our Braggot projects. Of course, Jeff had his in the hopper for quite some time now. But
mine's ready to bottle as soon as I get off my butt and clean some more bottles.
There you go. So, kind of a fun night tonight. Then we kind of ran the full gamut. Talked about, you know, the Braggot projects, the ciders. And we're getting into the cider, sizer season. So we'll be talking more about that here in the next few shows. So with that, hey, thanks for stopping by. If you're going to catch us on the download, themeadhouse.com, that's where you can pick it up. You can listen to us on iTunes as well, Stitcher Radio. The show is also broadcast live at tuneinradio.com as well as our very own Mead House, themeadhouse.com. So with that, we'll see everybody next Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Don't be late. We'll see you then.